Session number 18642, Real One.
Background interview, Brigadier Mike Calvert.
Well, can you just tell me how you got into?
Well, it goes back. Yeah. It goes back near the beginning of the war, when they formed during the Finnish War. They asked for volunteers for a ski battalion to go to Finland, and this was part of a much bigger operation. This is when Russia was allied with Germany, and Britain and France were very worried about the iron ore going from Sweden to Germany, and so Britain and France were going to ostensibly help Finland by doing an operation into Narvik and then crossing through Sweden to Finland. But in crossing Sweden, they were going to occupy these Swedish iron mines, you see. And
despite Swedish neutrality?
Yes. And so all the accusations which the Germans had when they landed in Norway, that we were going to break neutrality, were quite correct. And that's why the official history and things like that misses this out altogether. And they decided they had to have a ski battalion. And they couldn't get anybody to produce a ski battalion. So they asked the Canadians, and they wouldn't do it. They asked the light infantry, and they wouldn't do it. Eventually, the Scots Guards said they would. And the Scots Guards produced this, what we call the phony fifth, the fifth battalion of the Scots Guards. And they asked for volunteers all over the country, terribly secret. And then I was adjutant London, divisional engineers in Kent, TA. And I put it around to people who could ski. And they were all turned down, so I went myself. When I got there, all the officer positions had been filled. But I found lots of people, especially other Royal Engineers, who'd volunteered and were in the ranks. And they said, "Well, I come into the madhouse, come and join us." So I did join them, and we went out to France, Chamonix, to practice. And then we came home, and we got on board a ship, SS Batory, to go to the expedition. And then the Finnish War stopped. But we were going across here somewhere. There's Narvik, yeah. And then the iron ore mines are just here somewhere. And we were going to go across like that, you see. But in this ski battalion was where it became a sort of university almost, because there were all sorts of people, both civilians and military, and people who'd been in wars in different parts of the world, and we had an awful lot of time in our hands, and we talked and talked and talked, and we didn't want to have another 1914-18 war. We felt that we wanted to go for the guts, what we call, you know, a surgical operation, go for the nerve centers of your enemy. You don't need to have this awful slogging match like on the Western Front. And there was both David Stirling and Bill Stirling.
Then David was on the operation to
Yes, that's right. And there, in fact, nearly all the people who later formed Special Forces were in this battalion. Uh-huh. And so, as I said, it was rather like a sort of the 15th century university where all the ideas were coming, you see, and people interchanging ideas. And there's Jim Gavin, who's in Singapore. There's people from all over the Owen.
Which Owen was that? David Lloyd?
David Lloyd Owen.
He was in that as well, was he?
Yes.
I'm seeing him on Wednesday, so I
think he was in that.
I shall nudge him
gently. He knows me, yes. And so on. And we interchanged ideas. Well, then it was broken up. And then...
Which date would that have been?
I've got... I went to Norway after that, and but it was, and it was just before the Norwegian operation, mm-hmm. You see,
right.
Because there was very bad. Security, and the Germans got to know about this Scots Guards thing, and so they mounted this operation which seized all the ports in Norway, you see, and also so that they really had an excuse for doing it, that we were going to land. And then they sent up the operations to Norway. One was to Narvik, the other was to and I went to the Andalsnes. I immediately volunteered and went as a so-called adjutant base sub area, but my main job was to do demolitions.
Yeah.
And we were only there a fortnight, and I blew up with mines and depth charges, naval mines and depth charges. I blew up a railway and road whilst we did the retreats, you see. And so when I came back, I was asked to go and join a special training centre in Scotland as an instructor in demolitions and sabotage. Yeah. And the same chap as who formed the ski battalion, Colonel Coates, was forming this school at Loch Eilot in Scotland. And at the instructors, well, there was David Stirling and Bill Stirling.
Again.
And all these people who'd been in this thing, you see.
They were there as instructors.
A lot of them, yes, instructors, you see. And so we started to raise, first of all, the independent companies, which was the original of the commandos.
Yeah.
Well, then I was brought down to help organise guerrilla warfare in Kent and Sussex with Peter Fleming, and what happened was going to be was that we were going to defend the coast, you see, where we could, and then the main defences, the wall, was along the North Downs, and they wanted some, it was General Bulgy Thorne, who'd been military attaché with the Germans, and he wanted to have a guerrilla force between the coast and the thing, and we said we would blow up all the bridges and do this, that, and the other. The idea being that our main defences of Great Britain were somewhere around Oxford, the only armoured division we had, and they would just wait to see where the main landing was, and then they'd have a counterattack, and at the time of the counterattack, we would pop up and blow the bridges and this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. What I arranged with the Royal Engineers to dig secret hideouts all the way in Kent and Sussex, you see, underground places.
We did. I didn't direct it, but TVS did a half-hour film on some
people from Kent involved in this. Well, we started it. I know, yes, the sort of there. And I also mined a lot of the big houses. In case they would use it. Well, I got the Ministry of People to do a sort of appreciation of where the Germans would like to spend their things, and we'd mine them. And they also, I also mined quite a lot of bridges and so on like that. And we had our made up mines, like in milk churns and things like that, so they could wheel them in. So nobody's supposed to know anybody else, you know, only supposed to know your cell system. And we organised this, and then they spread it around the rest of the country later on. But by this time, I'd been... Churchill had written a letter. Now, this is important, because nobody knows about this. This letter exists, because I saw it. I saw it at the time. It's on the back of a file I was shown at the War Office. I was in a thing called Military Intelligence Research, MIR, they call this. And what happened was this. Churchill wrote a letter to all the prime ministers and the commander-in-chiefs around the world and said that whilst we intend to fight with every weapon and person of our ability, Britain might go under. If it does, the plan is that the royalty or the sovereign and the Royal Navy go to Canada and we go on fighting in Britain in a guerrilla warfare. Now, it's essential we fight all over the world in the form of guerrilla or paramilitary warfare until we can get strong allies, which we must try and draw into our fray, you see. He then said, I want you all to raise your own defensive guerrilla organization and also organize offensive guerrilla organization in the territory surrounding you.
Yeah.
And he then divided up the world into segments and gave each people like Australia and India and Canada and the Middle East and so on a segment to defend, you see.
Yeah.
And he said, I'll be sending out missions to you. He said, oh, one thing I found out is that all the knowledge of paramilitary warfare is centered on London. This is, of course, absurd. So I'm sending out missions to you, and you can... they're yours to do with what you like, but I recommend that the following points, that guerrilla warfare is a personal warfare, and it must be adapted to the people and the character of the people there, and also to the topography. And so each one of your types of guerrilla warfare will probably be different. And you should form your units within your country and also to set up an organization in your neighboring countries so that you can also operate there and raise forces against any occupied territory there. And so I went after interview, went on this mission 104 to Australia, New Zealand, where we raised the independent companies and the became the coast watchers and so on like that. Other missions were sent to different parts of the world, some, you know, like in Abyssinia.
Yeah.
They came from all three directions or five directions, from Kenya, from Aden, and from the Sudan and so on like that. Other missions they called Stay Behind, went to Malaya and to Hong Kong. And other countries or governments wouldn't have anything to do with them because, for instance, India didn't want to train a lot of people how to become guerrillas because they might operate against themselves, which of course happened at the end. We did, you see. A lot of the people we trained, like in Malaya, operated against us, you see, later on. So that, then I later on, after Australia, I went to China on a mission to China before the Pearl Harbor, and we, mission 204, and we had about 10 small missions which were going to China, but in fact about five of them got caught up in the war in Burma. And I was made commandant of a school teaching these people, you see. And it's there that I met Wingate.
Mm-hmm.
And I showed him around Burma. He'd been sent. And Wavell had asked for him, and he sent him along to see me. And so I took him all around Burma, and from him I got ideas I never even thought of before. Mm-hmm. In fact, to me, I wasn't doing much jungle warfare, because we were training to fight in China where there's no jungle.
Yes.
And we call ourselves the Jungle Warfare School, but in actual fact that was a cover name. But from that I got a reputation for being an expert in the jungle. But I did eventually. We formed our staff and we fought on the way out. But I found Wingate was miles ahead of anybody I'd ever spoken to. And so when I came out, I joined him with a lot of my staff, and we formed the nucleus of the first Chindit operation. There were two Chindit operations, and then I was lucky enough to get things being expanded, and he put me in command of a brigade which did the fly-in, the airborne operations in, and then we fought for 5 months behind the lines. Mm-hmm. Then I'd come out. I'd been pretty rude to people by the end, and I broke my Achilles tendon and got some other injuries, and I was sent home. I wanted to have some experience of European operations, and I didn't agree much with the general Wingate's successor, quite a useless person. When I came home, I got a lot of laudation, I was offered three things. One was a commando. Second was to go with Special Operations Executive, SOE, mm-hmm. to Manila on MacArthur's staff, because they wanted somebody who'd seen operations there. It would be really interesting if I hadn't gone, my life would have gone. Well, the third one was the SAS, I met some of the SAS people, and I was attracted to them. It's a very good organization. Now, I've got this, in that thing there, there's a short description of the SAS. I've got it, isn't it? Perhaps, I think I told you
yesterday. Yeah.
There's also some other ones. You know about this probably, I didn't tell you about how the expanded from the first step for him for a regiment, and then they had the regiment included SBS and so on, and then they formed the second SAS from North Africa.
Yeah.
And then it was brought over to Britain and placed under this Major General Roddy MacLeod, who was a very fine chap. And the great thing that Roddy MacLeod did, he got the whole thing, he was a good staff officer, he got the whole thing on a proper basis. Mm. I had a very good staff, a G1, with Baring, banking family, and a very good DAQMG and so on like that. He had a very good signals organization. From my desk in Essex, I could broadcast through the BBC to units in the field, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. Didn't use it only certain occasions. We had a phantom unit attached, signals units attached to us, and we are very close with the air supply and air support with the 38 group, and it was very well organized, except possibly the French. So they put a chap who'd been in the had commanded the long-range Desert Group, in charge of the French. Now, he was a very good chap for pure intelligence. Yeah. And intelligence, as you know, is meant to be all one way. You look, you don't act on your own intelligence, you just see what's happening and you report back. And what happens to your reports? You probably never see anything from them. Mm-hmm. That is the ideal of intelligence. Well, this is, of course, a bit more active. But on the whole, the long-range desert group was not supposed to take action. It could defend itself, but it was just meant to observe. And we didn't get on very well. We lived separate lives. I inherited him. And he was a clever chap, but he hadn't got the thirst for action, you see what I mean? I say this now. I've always said that the SAS and SOE, I call it, should be on the following, SOE or SIS or MI6, whatever you like to call them. SOE was separate from MI6, as you know. That they should prepare an organization in peacetime in any country, say Romania or something like that, and there should be people there who have been earmarked and picked to do it. And then when required, you send in your mujahideen, whatever you like to call them, SAS, who are the operators. I always said it's rather like a railway network, and you have the station masters and everything else who do supply and so on like that, and on it you have the rolling stock, you see, which is the thing. Now, the rolling stock should be a total different characters than the people who are there. People who are there are probably introverted type of people who, in, say, Romania and so on, and then you have the extroverts, who don't pay nearly so much attention to secrecy or security, only local tactical secrecy, and they come in and to hit things hard, and their job is to be extrovert and to be macho, you might say, and go in. Now, I think there's a great tendency to mix the two together. Well, you can, if you can do it, it's quite a good thing, but the snag is that you get very, very few people who've got both the introvert and the extrovert characteristics. You need them both, you see. And it's just as, for instance, the Indians into they did their operation in eastern Pakistan. They had these people who met them, took them across the rivers, did this, that, and the other, avoided the enemy, and got to Dhaka within 2.5 days, you see. But all the routes were mapped out, there were boats there were preparations made, and so on. Now, this is what I feel should happen for the SAS all over the world, all liable to operate. But the SAS should, although its operations should naturally be secret, but they should be quite a different type to an intelligence person who remains hidden the rest of his life. And I think it's also, this is getting into sort of governmental, almost university type of things, the principle is you should never have an intelligence organization which can take advantage of its own intelligence, i.e., which can operate on its own intelligence. You must have a separate thing. You have intelligence, and then that goes, and then it goes back to high command, and then operations. But if you have an intelligence organization which can operate, it starts operating, and you have the nonsense which happened with the Americans doing operations without the high command knowing about it, you see. So they should never have any men to operate with, you see what I mean. Anyway, I came back and was selected to take over the SAS, and there was first and second SAS in Essex. They were living rather a country house existence, going off to the races and doing this. And they reckoned they'd fought the war. And then I was ordered by the director of AR, and they'd also made themselves so they were half under the Foreign Office and half under the Army and half under the Air Force, so they could always say no to anything they didn't like. And I was put in to get them all together and to get them going. This chap from the Long Desert Group was in charge of the French. Well, I was told that I must get them all into action within 3 weeks and they must get moving.
Mm-hmm.
And so I dashed out and saw the army commanders in Europe, and they were longing for some people with go in them. After Normandy and everything else like that, this was in January 1945, the thing had become very professional. You didn't advance unless you had to, you know. When any advance was done, you put a massive amount of artillery or bombing in front of it. You then went forward with your tanks, and the object was to gain ground without casualties. That's very often there are very many more casualties. And
why were there a lot more casualties?
Well, because it was rather like not grasping a nettle firmly, you know.
Yeah.
You, in trying to avoid casualties, you usually get more.
Yeah.
And I remember the ex-Speaker of the House of Commons, who was a staff officer on Monty's staff, and he said to me afterwards that he'd lost five of his best friends who were company commanders and who couldn't get their men forward and had to lead from in front and of course got killed. And this happens to all armies, I think. And what, you know, the thing is that in any battalion there's only a few dozen people who are real keen fighters. And once they start getting killed off, if you might have 10% casualties, but might mean 50% effectiveness in attack, because all your best people have been killed, the people who lead and do this, that, and the other. They can be all wrecks, you know. And this is what the British Army was rather suffering from, and the Canadian Army. So they were anxious to get, they're very pleased to have SAS people who would push forward. And the general idea is rather like with the Chindits, they said, if those bastards can do it, we can, you know. And they may have necessarily done it better than them. But they had these armored jeeps. And first SAS under Paddy Main, he put in a lot of objections, but he couldn't have given me greater loyalty and care. He was very, very careful, not of his men, and so he'd do very good planning. But he went ahead with this front of Second Army, and we even started fitting rockets onto these armored jeeps. They had, you know what an armored jeep looks like.
Yeah.
And so that we could deal with Tiger tanks. And he did some very good operations there. Brian Franks of 2nd SAS, I don't know what he was like in action, he must have been good, but he knew all the aristocracy. So he could go and see General Dempsey, and he'd complain that this is not what we're cast out for, and I had to give him a hell of a rocket to get him going on again and doing things. And he was all right. They were all right once they did it, but one had to try to explain the situation. He said, you've got to lead these people. They're packing up. And And then General, what's his name, Chief of Staff to Monty, I can't remember his name, but he saw me and he said, the place for you to go is up in with the Canadian Army.